You're listening to a podcast from 702.
702. Masterclass.
As mentioned, we are very lucky to be joined by an expert on the issue of intellectual property, Prof. Owen Dean, Emeritus Professor of IP Law at the University of Stellenbosch. And so he will be on with us for the masterclass. And if you have a question, or maybe you have an experience of having a really great idea, which you thought was brilliant, but then you saw someone else use it, or you shared it with someone and then that someone used it. Maybe you have an experience of giving away an idea or thinking you were sharing an idea, but it turns out you were giving it away. Before we get into our conversation with the prof, there are always stories about someone claiming that an idea of theirs was stolen. A couple of months ago, there were allegations against the very popular Dinner at Somizi show, which airs on MultiChoice. A man called Hastings Moeng said Somizi got sent his idea in 2014, an idea for the show, which currently airs on One Magic. And then he says he was surprised to see the show then be commissioned and air without him, even though he said he'd sent this idea in 2014. Both the channel, the presenter, the production company say, you know, they didn't take Hastings' idea from 2014. But we hear about this kind of story quite often. A show does really well, or it launches on a channel, and someone says, hang on, that was my idea. I came up with that. In 2016, most famously, Robin Thicke and Pharrell Williams had to pay the Marvin Gaye estate just over $5 million. This is after they were sued for copyright infringement. You may remember in 2013, you couldn't miss the song, whether you liked it or not. Robin Thicke, Pharrell Williams, and T.I. released a song called Blurred Lines. The Marvin Gaye estate accused them of copying or infringing on the copyright of Marvin Gaye's hit song called Got to Give It Up, which came out in 1977. The matter dragged on for many, many years until finally a jury ruled in favor of the Marvin Gaye estate. They were claiming $7 million. It was then reduced to $5.3 million. And if you don't know which two songs we are speaking about, this was the very popular, it was everywhere. It was the song of the summer by Robin Thicke, Pharrell Williams, and T.I., a song that got them into trouble after making them a lot of money, called Blurred Lines.
Everybody get up.
So that was Robin Thicke, Pharrell, and T.I. It came out in 2013, a track called Blurred Lines. The Marvin Gaye estate said, hang on, this sounds very similar to a song that came out in 1977. And this was the song. It's called Got to Give It Up. So that's Marvin Gaye, a song from the 70s, Got to Give It Up, was also a huge hit. And in the end, the Marvin Gaye estate won their case. $5.3 million needed to be paid to the estate. And that was just another example of an instance where, you know, someone said, hang on, that really popular thing sounds like something of mine. And I'd like to bring in Professor Owen Dean on this conversation. Prof, thank you so much for your time this afternoon. So obviously America is very different to South Africa, but in general, what is intellectual property? When we speak about IP, what exactly are we talking about? Is it just the great idea in my head?
Well, firstly, let me thank you for inviting me to join your show. It's a real treat for me. Look, intellectual property is a name given for a group of laws which all have the purpose of protecting the product of the mind. There are four main forms of intellectual property. They are patents, which protect inventions, trademarks, which protect brands, Copyright, which protects the expression of ideas in the form of music or literary works or paintings and so forth. And then the fourth form is designs. In other words, the outward shape of a product, the way in which you recognize a product from its shape. So those are the four forms of intellectual property.
Mm-hmm.
And what they have in common is that they are all intangible. They don't exist as physical items of property. So they are the product of the intellect, and hence the name intellectual property.
If they don't exist necessarily physically, then how do you protect an idea? So if I have a great idea for a song, a show, an innovation, how do I then protect something that doesn't quite exist yet?
Well, that's where one of these branches of the law comes into practice. If your idea takes the form of an invention, a new product, a new way of doing something, then you register a patent, and once you've registered a patent, you are given a right of property in that patent. When it comes to something like a song, for instance, the idea of the song, if one can talk about that, is not protected. It only becomes protected once you reduce it into a material form. In other words, you record it, or you write it down in musical notation to give it some physical form.
Mm-hmm.
And a brand becomes protected when you register it as a trademark at the trademarks office. Alternatively, you use it to such an extent that it becomes very well known and people recognize it as an indication that someone is using to denote his product. Say, for instance, Coca-Cola. Coca-Cola is so well known that everybody knows that Coca-Cola is a particular brand of cool drink.
Mm-hmm.
And then a design, as I say, the shape of an article. For instance, let's take the example of a Philips electrical razor. It has a particular distinctive shape. That is registered as a design at the designs office, and once you get your registration, then you have a protection for that design. But an idea in the abstract is not protected. For instance, I can have a brilliant idea for a new game show, and I can have it in my head exactly how the thing will work,
mm-hmm.
until I reduce it into some sort of form, and here we're probably talking copyright. You write down a script, as it were, for the show, you don't have any protection for it.
So if I have a really great idea and I don't put it down on paper or note it or record it or in some way, I guess, make it a real thing in the real world, that idea is not protected yet.
Absolutely. That's exactly the situation.
So if someone else then, so say you and I have an idea for a game show, it happens on a Wednesday afternoon and it's exactly the same, and you then, you know, pitch it to a channel or pitch it to someone who can fund it, I would then, if I hadn't put the idea down, I don't have claim on that idea yet or at all.
No, you don't. As long as the idea is simply existing in your mind, it is unprotected. And people make a lot of mistakes in that regard. People come short when they go, for instance, to a television station and say, here's this fantastic idea for a show, and they explain the whole thing. And then 6 months later, a television program appears with that format and giving effect to that idea, and they get upset and they say, you've stolen my idea. Well, the simple answer is there was nothing, no property that was stolen, because it was simply an idea.
Okay. I think I follow. If you've just joined us...
What you can do, and in order to sort of bridge this gap, and this is what is often recommended to people, is that if you've got a good idea, say, for instance, for a game show, and you want to go and talk to a television company to see whether they're interested, you approach them and you say to them, look, I've got this great idea. Roughly, this is what it's all about, but I'm not going to give you the full scope of it. Unless and until you enter into an agreement with me that if you use my idea, then you will give me some piece of the action, a royalty, or you'll pay me a lump sum or something like that, then they are bound by contract, which is a different kind of legal principle, but they're bound by a contract to give you recognition for your idea.
Mm-hmm. Joined on the line by Prof. Owen Dean. He is Emeritus Professor of IP Law at the University of Stellenbosch for this week's masterclass, speaking about ideas. How do you protect them? When do they belong to you? And we'd love to hear from you on 011-883-0702. Your SMS is on 31702. You can also send us your WhatsApp messages on 072-702-1702 as we continue with this week's masterclass.
702 Masterclass.
21 minutes after 2 o'clock. Yes, it is this week's masterclass talking about IP, intellectual property. What is it? What do you need to know? How do you and when can you protect your ideas? Speaking to Professor Owen Dean, Professor of IP Law at the University of Stellenbosch. Prof, just before the break, you were speaking about an idea can't be protected if it just is a great idea in your head and you haven't given it life or recorded it in some way. But even once you record it, what do you need to know? So for instance, if you record something and you hear it or you hear something similar, is that enough to claim your idea, or maybe it is a copyright in this instance, if it's a musical work or creative work, is it enough to say it sounds like mine or looks like mine to say it's been stolen or my copyright has been infringed? What do you need to prove?
Well, you mentioned copyright, and that's apposite, because copyright is really the area in which most people think in terms of things being stolen. And let's take a song, for instance. You played those two songs, Marvin Gaye's and the one which was copied from it, or claimed to be copied from it.
Mm-hmm.
When you write down, you dream up your song, you write it down or you record it, so you cast it in a material form, it then enjoys copyright. You are entitled to prevent anyone else from reproducing a substantial part of that song. Now, this raises two issues. Firstly, what is a substantial part? It's something besides an exact copy. So it can be a copy which is recognizable, but it's a question of degree, and many court cases, as was the case with Marvin Gaye, turn on whether there was too much copied or what extent of the copying took place. And then the second issue you have to show is that there was actual copying, that in other words, there is what is termed a causal connection between the first song and the second song. Is the second song derived from the first song?
Mm-hmm.
Because if it should happen that two people should write substantially identical songs without one copying the other, then there's no copyright infringement. Both of those elements must be present. There must be a substantial similarity, and secondly, that substantial similarity must be due to copying.
I just want to go to River Club. Jane has a question about writing a book. Jane, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Gogs and Prof. Dean. I'd like to know, please, if you write a book, so you've written a book, a business book, a concept that is not out there, you send it off to your publisher. Your publisher says, no, your book's rubbish. But 6 months later, on the shelves, there's a book using your very similar concepts. What protection do you have? Because I know in the old days, I used to work in the creative industry, and people used to write movie scripts, and they'd send them off to Hollywood, but they always sent themselves, apparently what you did was you sent yourself a registered copy of the script in an envelope, and it was stamped that it was yours to protect yourself. I don't know. I'm just curious to know. Please.
Well, to retain a copy of what you send is very important, because, as I said earlier, no protection comes into existence until it is reduced in a material form. So your first written version is your material form, and it's important that you should be able to refer to that when you want to claim someone has copied you. One thing one needs to appreciate about intellectual property and copyright in particular is that although a measure of protection is given to ideas, What is actually protected is the material expression of the idea. In other words, the text of what you've written. So when, if in your example you've given, you send a script, you told it's rubbish, and some more time later a similar book comes out, if all that is present in the second book is the same concept without any suggestion that the wording has been copied or the format has been copied or something along those lines, it's going to be very difficult to prove copyright infringement. But more often than not, you will find some traces where there has been copying of the language or the structure, which enables you to say, well, that's not an independently reached idea or work. It has been derived from my work. But it's not an easy thing, and it's a bit of a value judgment that the court has to make as to whether there is the substantial similarity. I said there was a two-step test. There's got to be substantial similarity, and there's got to be a connection between the two. So that is what you would have to show. And you would show that by saying, well, here's my script. I sent it in. They had access to it. The author of the second book presumably saw it. And therefore the similarity is due to the fact that copying took place.
Great, thank you.
Thank you so much for your call, Jane. Let's go to Boksburg with Dinesh. Dinesh, good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you. Good afternoon, Prof.
Good afternoon.
My question, I run a occupational health and safety consulting company for the last 11 years. I designed with my 36 years experience systems that's actually put down in paper, and I sell it to the client. And in most cases, client actually take that and give it to other clients, and where I don't get any income from there. But it's my experience and education that actually took me to write all this material. How am I protected by the Intellectual Property Act?
Well, this ties in to some extent with the previous question. The point is what you write and what you submit to your clients is protected by copyright, but it is the material expression of the idea which is protected, not the idea per se. So if somebody takes your material, reads it, throws it away, and goes away, and using the knowledge which is gained from reading your material, writes his own independent material, then he's not infringing your copyright. But if he takes shortcuts, and the way the courts have put it, if he produced, this is now the second author, if he has produced his work with, so to speak, your work at his elbow, then the chances are that he has infringed your copyright. But the basic principle is that the knowledge and ideas per se are not protected. It is the material expression of the idea which is protected.
Okay, in this case, I'll just give you an example of what I discovered at one of a new client that I went. It was a copy and paste of my original work. The only thing that was changed was his logo was put there with another company's logo.
On the facts as you present them, I would say there is undoubtedly a case of copyright infringement.
All right. Thank you very much, Prof. Much appreciated.
Thanks for your call, Dinesh. Prof, in terms of then, if you, that two steps, the substantial similarity, the connection, what is then the next step? Do you go to the courts? Is it a criminal matter, a civil matter? How long does that process take?
Well, if we're talking copyright, you can bring a civil claim, or you can also bring a criminal charge, although it's fairly rare for criminal charges to be brought. Usually it's a civil case. And typically what would happen is that you would write a letter to the person who has done the copying and say, look, you've copied my work, you've infringed my copyright, I'm entitled to institute court proceedings against you for an interdict, an order stopping you from distributing your work any further. And secondly, I'm entitled to claim damages from you. And if you're lucky, that person capitulates and says, all right, well, I don't want to get involved in court proceedings. Let's discuss a way out of this. and you can reach a settlement. But if he doesn't, then what you have to do, if you want to take it further, is you have to institute court proceedings in the High Court for copyright infringement. And that can be a very expensive process, unfortunately. And it can also be quite time-consuming. In general, I would say it's seldom that you would get a result, the court order you're looking for, in under a year.
I just want to pause there, Prof. It is just up.
702 Masterclass.
22 minutes before 3 o'clock, still continuing with our masterclass, speaking intellectual property. When is an idea your idea? How can you protect it? And what do you need to know? And we're joined by Professor Owen Dean, Emeritus Professor of IP Law at the University of Stellenbosch. Prof, we have a question here on SMS saying, I'd like to ask the professor if one can patent a portion of a language. Example, Disney patenting Hakuna Matata, which of course they was quite a big phrase from the 1994 Lion King movie. They did it again when they redid the movie last year. And there has been a big campaign of people saying, you know, Disney shouldn't be allowed to trademark or register what is a popular Swahili phrase. And in this instance, is it a trademark? Is it a copyright? How would it work with something like a phrase?
Yeah, it's very important to distinguish between the various types of intellectual property. You started off by saying patenting Hakuna Matata. Well, that's totally out of the question because patent deals with an invention. Something physical like a new kind of machine or a new pump or whatever. Words generally are only capable of being protected as a trademark. Hakuna Matata could be a trademark, although as Disney used it as the name of its song, it really doesn't perform a trademark function, because the function of a trademark is to say this is the product of XYZ company. Now, that's not really how Hakuna Matata was used as the name of the song. If you consider it as a trademark, you cannot register something which is reasonably required for use in the trade. Like, for instance, you couldn't register beer, the word, for a beer product because it's descriptive and everybody needs to be able to describe their beer by the use of the term beer. So Hakuna Matata could not be registered in respect of anything for which its meaning has some relevance. Copyright is another possibility, but the courts have said you can't really get copyright in a single a single word, and so I would rule out that possibility. So the only real possibility that Disney would have to protect Hakuna Matata would be as a trademark, and they could go and register it as a trademark for entertainment services or for a musical production, but I would doubt whether that would be a valid trademark because it's not really being used in the trademark sense.
Mm. We've seen over the last couple of years, I guess as we have more access to celebrity culture, some celebrities trying to trademark the names of their children. So Beyonce and Jay-Z trademarked Blue Ivy. We've seen, you know, in battles between certain stars and their record labels claiming that person X may not perform under their name because it belongs to the record company. How does it work in the instance of a name? And do we have, and again, a lot of it is sort of American based. How would it work here? Can you claim, you know, IP over a name, even if it is a stage name?
Well, once again, the only possibility would be under trademark law. Now, for a trademark to be registrable, it must be distinctive. It must be capable of distinguishing one person's product from another, and it can't be done if it's a descriptive term. Now, if you took a name like Blue Ivy, and you decided you wanted to use that for, let's say, for instance, furniture polish. That ought to be quite possible because Blue Ivy has no generic significance for furniture polish. Mm-hmm. However, if you wanted to register it for jewelry, it may be a different story because blue ivy does have some descriptive significance as far as jewelry is concerned. So it depends on what the word is, and secondly, in respect of what product or what service you want to register it. When you register a trademark, you don't get a blanket right to use the name for everything under the sun. You protect it in respect of a particular product, like Coca-Cola is protected for cool drink. It's not protected for, let's say, for instance, cement.
Mm-hmm.
It's a totally different kind of product, and so one wouldn't think in terms of the Coca-Cola company producing cement. So your rights are limited to the field in which you use the trademark.
Let's go to Joburg South. We have Gregory with a question about music and IP. Gregory, good afternoon.
Hi. Nice to be speaking to Greg. I'm just for your guest. So if there's an intellectual property dispute relating to music, so when it's the court referred to the court, who does the court refer to? Is it colleges? Is it universities? To look at the content of the music, the theory of the music, or is it just the tune? The tune may sound similar, the chord changes. You know, I'm a musician, so that's why I'm asking this question. I mean, how is that decided? But clear and present would be, hey, this tune is copied because it sounds the same. But there has to be some deeper exploration that there's some plagiarism from the theory point of view. And who would the courts refer to in that case?
Well, it's a play.
702 Masterclass.
10 minutes before 3 o'clock, we are still in this week's masterclass discussing intellectual property with Emeritus Professor of IP Law at the University of Stellenbosch, Professor Owen Dean. And we have Deboho from Buccleuch on the line. Deboho, good afternoon.
Yes. Afternoon, thank you. Beautiful and very necessary discussion. Hello, Dr. Owen Dean. You lectured me at Stellenbosch for the Introduction to Intellectual Property course, and I want to pick your brain because of you and I had a quick discussion with Kariska on the issue of the Copyright Amendment Bill. I know there are issues there, and the industry, the IP industry is very divided. But after our discussion, I actually realized that we've got to begin some way. And yes, it may not be perfect, but I think it's in line with the global standards and with the digital era. What are your views as it is right now? As you know that the president had to send it back to Parliament, citing some constitutional concerns. Dr. Owen Dean, I'm listening.
I do not favor it. I think it's a very bad piece of legislation. My objections are based on two levels. The one is that the draftsmanship is very poor. The terminology that is used is confused, and it will almost definitely lead to a lot of litigation. The second is that it adopts some concepts which are wrong, in my view. You say it's in line with international standards. Well, I would dispute that. There are many areas where it's not in line with international standards. And I think it's not going to be a good day for South African copyright law if and when the state president ever gets around to signing the bill.
But what do you think about the exclusion of the partially sighted and blind people? I mean, tomorrow, blind essays leading a march to the Union Building about that very same matter is very unconstitutional. The 1978 current bill that we're sitting with is actually unconstitutional. It doesn't give them access at all.
It's not all bad. I mean, when I say it's a bad piece of legislation, it's not all bad. There are areas which it addresses which need to be addressed and where changes to the existing law are very necessary. But the bad parts outweigh the good parts. And it's unfortunate that something like, for instance, giving particular freedoms to blind people is suffering the fate of some of the other bad stuff. What I have said and the advice I've given to the government, for what it's worth, is that what you need to do is you need to go back to the drawing board. You need to decide what it is, what issues you want to address and how you want to address them, and then form a committee of real experts, not people who have very little experience in the field, and ask them to prepare legislation which meets the very specific objectives which you have set. And that's the way forward. To legislate the current bill is asking for trouble. It's going to set our copyright law back many years, and it's going to cause horrible confusion and an enormous amount of litigation.
Deboho, we're going to have to leave it at that. Thank you very much for your call. That's Deboho in Buccleuch. Prof, I've been meaning for us to come to this particular issue. What happens with ideas you come up with at work? How do those work, or ideas you come up with at school? I know, and I don't know if it was a rumor, we actually never checked, but one of the shocking things we learned at university was that, you know, work produced through our thesis or research we did as part of our studies was technically work that belonged to the university. And again, you know, it kind of spread through the grapevine. So no one explained how that worked. But how do ideas work when you are either commissioned, you are employed, you are working for someone? What belongs to who?
All right. Well, it's quite a complex, many-faceted question. But the starting point is that the property, be it copyright or an invention, whatever, but let's take copyright as an example, belongs to the person who creates the work. In copyright law, you talk about the author. The author is a technical term which could include a painter or a composer, but the Copyright Act uses the term author. So the author is initially in, like, the default position is that the author is the owner of the copyright. However, there are exceptions to that rule. One exception is if you make a work in the course of your employment by another person, then the employer owns the copyright, not the author. A second exception is if, in the case of certain works, like, for instance, taking of a photograph, if the work is made pursuant to a commission, in other words, someone says, I instruct you to take this photograph and I will pay you for it, in that instance, the commissioner, not the author, is the copyright owner. Mm-hmm. Another exception, in a sense, is if parties agree between themselves that someone else besides the author is going to be the owner. Now, this is what commonly happens at universities. If you do a doctoral thesis, for instance, built into the process is an agreement between you and the university that the university will own the copyright in the thesis. But the default position, as I say, with if none of these exceptions apply, is that the person who makes the work is the first owner of the property.
Unless then, you know, it is commissioned work, or it is, you know, the other exceptions.
Made in the course of employment. That's the most common one. The most common exception is where the work is made as part of your job.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if I'm a lawyer working for a law firm and I write opinions and I do it in the course of being employed by the law firm, then the law firm earns the copyright in the opinion, not me personally, even though I wrote it, because I wrote it in the course of my employment. It's part of my job.
And if you do something that's outside of your scope of work, so say you're employed as someone in the finance department, you come up with an innovation or an idea that is used in the sales department or, you know, in another, is there then another exception there?
Well, if we turn on the interpretation of the phrase in the course of employment, and in practical terms, that means if it's part of your job description. Now, if you are in the finance department and you, for instance, dream up a nice jingle for the advertising department, that's not in the course of your employment. Although you're employed by the company, you're not employed to write jingles, you're employed to do financial matters. So it's one looks at the job description, and it's only if it falls within your job description that the employer becomes the owner.
Professor, thank you so much for your time and your insight this afternoon. It's been a pleasure speaking to you.
You're most welcome.
That's Professor Owen Dean, Emeritus Professor of IP Law at the University of Stellenbosch, for this